Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 59. And this is with Martin Lichtmess and Carolina Sommerfeld. So, welcome to the channel.
Hello.
Hello.
So, I'm not sure if your audio is coming through, but can you say something, Martin?
Have we but well enough in time? Just calling this lady when a crime.
Right, that's fine. Yes, that's fine. Yes. So, you appeared on my channel earlier this year, about a month ago. I visited Vienna, and we filmed two conversations together, and they were very popular. Actually, people liked them. So, people will know some people who are watching will be familiar with you. But why don't you introduce yourself to people so that just in case anyone doesn't know you.
All right. So, my name is Martin Lichtmess. I'm Austrian. I live in Vienna, and I'm a writer, translator, contributor to a German New Right magazine called Secession, which just means secession. I have penned several books, and this is basically what I do. And with me is Caroline Sommerfeld. She's also a writer for Secession, and me and her, we co-authored a book, which is now in Germany and Austria. In fact, it has become a sort of bestseller, you know, in our league. And it had some interesting reviews, even in mainstream media. But we can talk about it later. But this is basically what we do.
Right. So how did you, this is the question I ask everyone. How did you get into this? We'll start with Martin.
Yeah. You mean into becoming right-wing willings or so?
Into the
yes.
scene, into
Sicily.
Yeah.
I guess. I start first because okay. I'm around a bit longer. It's actually a bit of a long story, but, when I started to get interested into political things, I wasn't really interested in the political side of it. So I was more interested in art and certain kinds of aesthetics and so on. I mean, back then, 20 years ago, I was in the goth scene, and I still wear black, you see. So, and I was into the neo folk shit, you know.
And was that the mid 90s?
In the late 90s, late 90s, when I got started, and so yeah. And I started writing around 2005, film school. I grew more and more political over the time, and I started with film reviews. I wanted to write film reviews that had a political angle, and I started to read all that new European New Right stuff or German New Right stuff that was around. And gradually, I grew into this role of becoming a full-time professional writer of books, and this is basically how I ended up there, you know. But initially, you know, I didn't come from any conservative or right-wing milieus. It was just an inner development. But I think I was always true to myself. I think I was already right-wing before I knew I was, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's something, actually, I think it's something you are, or some people are born with, so to speak. Maybe it's even something genetic, and it's just a certain way how you feel about the world, how you perceive things, what kind of values are inside you. And I think much of it is about who you are, you know. And people who have a good connection to what they are inside, they will always find that way. So I found my way from, you know, I was surrounded from a completely leftist liberal milieu, but I was dissatisfied, and so this is how I choose the right-hand path, so to speak.
Mm. So, Carolina, what about you? You were a leftist up until quite recently, I believe.
Well, if I tell my story I think I can tell a consistent story about myself without lying, and I can't say that I have been an definite leftist, and then I turned, and now I am so to say, a definite rightist, but it was kind of a more than ecological liberal milieu. I was
green.
Green,
like,
yeah,
like green guys, you know.
Yeah, well, my father was one of the founders of the Green Party in the north of Germany, in that Bundesland, in that part of North Germany, in 1979, when I was 4 years old. So that milieu I was growing up in. So, but I think from
you still look like it.
I mean, the
way she's dressed is very much like 80s green ecological alternative.
Well,
kind of people.
The only thing I still have Birkenstock shoes, but not the characteristic ones. Anyway, I think when I tell my story, I have ever been kind of righteous in my heart.
Just like me, in a similar way.
It is kind of true, because I was always, from childhood on, I remember my mother accusing me of being amoral or being kind of egotistic or things like this, not liberal and everyone has to love everyone else.
You were not cozy enough.
No,
you had a dislike of humanist, cozy,
The feeling of the strong feeling of being forced to be good. This acquainted me to Nietzsche, and I was reading such stuff from, say, the age of 16, 17 on. And later I studied philosophy. I even graduated with a doctor's degree in philosophy. And this was, I have three children. This was the time when my oldest son was a baby or a toddler, and later I had a lot of time to do things with nature, and I ran a community garden, for example, things like this. And just the year 2015 was the cut. This was really a disruption of my life, when I thought, okay, what everyone around me now, then already living in Vienna too, like Martin, in that time, everyone around me really appreciated what was going on. They were really furious. They were really enthusiastic about this immigration thing.
We're talking about summer 2015, when we had this huge
September
influx and so on. And it was insane. I mean, but not everybody perceived it that way. You say
no.
People,
I had the feeling they really laughed what was going on. They really ran to the Westbahnhof, that was a station in Vienna where they, all the trains arrived from the south, and they were really, friends of mine were there with open arms and brought toys there, and brought the little children there to play with the refugee children.
There were no children.
There were no children. It was just kind of...
Why were people glad? I mean, it sounds absolutely mad. It sounds completely insane for people to love what was going on at that time, because to me that's like saying they loved their own replacements arriving. Which is horrifying, to be honest. So why did people love it?
They have the feeling that they can do good to strangers, because they have nothing else to do good to, except for their own children, their own family. But even this is kind of...
I think there were different kind of reactions. Like some people like you, who were not initiated into writing wisdom yet, you had a gut feeling about it. You saw that, and you were also at the train station, you saw this masses of people, and you had this gut feeling something's definitely wrong and strange
and
here.
My deepest feeling was it is definitely kind of horrifying, kind of disgusting, and it is why do those people come to us and not everyone else from the world, kind of nicer populations from somewhere, let's say Asians or whatever.
I mean, they took a long way to get here.
Yeah,
you know,
indeed.
It took a long
yeah.
way all over Eastern Europe and Southeastern Europe and so, Balkan route and so. And but apparently some people, they didn't perceive it like that first. I mean, many of the perceptions, I think they were shaped by the media, who produced at that time a real hysteria about it. Like, you know, here's something, you know, a chance to do something good, you know, to help, you know, really poor people. In the media, you would rather focus on women and children. And so, I mean, I went to the train station, I saw a few of them. I was just this young man, it really felt like a wartime scene. At that time, I really felt like it felt like a war was breaking out, and yet I saw people sitting there, these middle-aged women, possibly with no children, or these, you know, I don't know, what do you call these green wimpish beta cup kind of guys, and they were sitting there, and they had these toys for children, and there were no children around to give them the toys to. I mean, I guess many of them, they just went there. The perceptions told them to see what they wanted to see. And I think with a few, they had this cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. They realized, okay, something's not quite fit in here, you know. Mm-hmm. And most people, they didn't see what we saw. They didn't actually go there. They just perceived it through the media. And then, you know, it's easy on Facebook. You write some shit and everybody joins. It becomes like a snowball of virtue signaling hysteria.
I know about friends of mine who still went there very often and even collected, say, children's toys and clothes. We went to children's flea market, kind of vintage toys and clothes and things, and they were collecting everywhere. So do you still have some shoes for the poor children? And it was really a huge imagination that it was poor people to be helped, like in the kind of biblical job they have to do, like help the poor, help the helpless.
Is it still, I mean, how... Did people ever realize, eventually realize this isn't children? This is mostly fighting age men.
Yeah, I think the peak of that welcome hysteria was quite soon over. I think in autumn, in November, there was the terrorist attack in Paris, the huge one, Bataclan. At that point, there were also things happening here. There were rapes, there were crimes increasing, there were just too many people, you know. I mean, they were put into small towns where there was the population was smaller than the people they put there, actually, and all that. So lots of problems arose, and there was a sort of Ernüchterung, I miss the word now, you know. So people got sober, many people got sober, you know. And so, and here at that point happened this... what we still have today, this polarization, and our society is really split into to a very strong degree.
So my first problem was that I had the feeling I have no one to talk to about my feelings, and I thought it was just...
You have to get to the point where you discover secession, no?
Exactly. Yeah. I had no one to discuss except for one colleague or friend who really said to me, well, I understand why you have this strange feeling about these masses coming, because they are Muslims. And he turned out to be really kind of, anti-Islamic. And so I thought, okay, well, at least one person I have to talk to. And he gave me lots of videos, but I'm not that video style or video type.
You're not a reading type.
Definitely. Yeah. I need texts to read. And then in an ordinary mainstream paper, say like Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeit, Süddeutsche, I don't know, whatever kind of German big newspaper, they were writing about right-wing intellectuals. It was not a big article. I don't remember anything except for a list. And on that list, there were three or four different things they mentioned, Junge Freiheit and so on, and Secession. Mm. And I thought, okay, this is, and they described it as the most intellectual magazine. And
But it was an article that was trying to put us into a negative light, you know, like,
sure.
So here are the bad guys. But it's funny because obviously this has a reverse effect, like, don't read that, you know, it's naughty. And then, of course, people get curious. And so they
I have always been told that there is no such thing in the world like right wing intellectuals. Intellectuals have to be leftist.
Contradiction, because
you
can't be intellectual and right wing because you're too clever to be right wing. This is the idea.
Leftist people believe that. I think it's an oxymoron that it can't be possible to be intellectual and right wing at the same time. So anyway, I wrote that article. I thought, okay, this makes me curious, and it's just one click away, and then I found this Secession homepage, and I thought, well, okay, exactly, that's the stuff I need.
Because I had written it, you know.
Indeed.
An article about pathological altruism. It was what actually was going on.
Exactly, and I had really a strong problem with the empathy thing that people were
pushing all the time. They say, you know, this is what a thing you always hear. You have to be empathic. You're cold hearted. Mm-hmm. You know, this is why your heart doesn't melt when you see all these invaders arriving and all that.
Indeed, and this is. Then I started reading, and I really kind of fall in love with texts, and I found, okay, this is really wonderful. I need more of this, and there is a function that you can comment on the texts on this.
The cognitive dissonance was dissolved suddenly. Mm-hmm. Clicked for you, and you realized your perceptions and the description did match.
There are others who had the same perceptions, and they were not naive. Like, well, I also don't like what's going on, but it was kind of filtered through an intellectual pattern or through ideas and thoughts that that have been prepared before I found them. And this was really, it was really...
A huge relief.
Deeply relief. And then I started commenting on what was written there. And there were lots of articles about that migration thing during that time. Mm. And while I was commenting, Martin, one day he contacted me, because it is possible for the authors to contact.
You wrote in the comment section, you left your email, and you mentioned you were living in Vienna, and so I invited you to come to the Identitarian meeting.
Exactly.
Which is once in a month in Vienna.
Mm-hmm. And at first I thought, maybe I shouldn't go, because I, on the one hand, said, well, I have a family, I have a husband, I think they won't appreciate that.
And your husband, you have to mention this, it's part of your story.
Now comes the husband's story. No,
he's very left-wing, so.
Indeed. We always have disputations, discussions, even quarrels about all that stuff.
You came there because you thought you were a bit worried, because you said you wouldn't be accepted because you look too left-wing and so on.
Maybe they have kind of they have ideas.
Fulfill
exactly,
or
they would sort me out because I don't look the right way.
But you had some ideas as well, which had to be corrected.
When you
came there.
Yeah.
You didn't know what
happened.
You realized. So I'm yeah, okay.
It was really cool, because we started at that situation. Martin was reading from Albert Camus.
The
other Camus.
The one who doesn't like sketches.
Later, I started talking to him, and we were talking there for about 3 hours, even though it was kind of a public meeting, so everyone should talk to everyone, but we were just talking to each other. And then from that time on, permanent.
I drag you into the swamp. I made you join the outlaws.
Well, my husband once said he has the feeling he's kind of a guru to me.
Yeah, well, not exactly.
Not exactly.
So I think the key thing here is that you were alone, and the public in general were, you said cognitive dissonance, and the public in general were just completely brainwashed. Really, it's a scary idea. Martin, how has this come about? I mean, how is it that the people of Vienna or Austria can't see that they're being replaced?
Well, some can, and you know, there has been a lot of things changing ever since. For example, probably you have followed the elections in Austria. We now have a center-right government. Even the Freedom Party is in the government now. And one of the reasons why they were so successful is because they were the only ones that said, we have to correct this migration politics. It doesn't work anymore. So it wasn't just the Freedom Party. It was also they used to be the black party. They are kind of the Tory party, you know, with a B. It's like the Republicans or the Tories. In Austria, and they shifted to the right as well, And they took over some ideas from the Freedom Party. And we have this young chancellor. He's quite young. He's just 30 years old. Chancellor Kurz. He has done a good job as a foreign minister, I think. Mm-hmm. I had an increasing respect of what he was doing. I don't know about some say he's opportunistic, but I don't care. You know, I just care that the right thing is to be done, you know, the thing that is needs to be done. So there is a change in the public consciousness, definitely, you know. This gives me a bit more hope, you know. But still, you know, perceptions are still split. Some people see what's happening, some rather don't, they deny it. I mean, it also depends on where you live. If you live in Vienna, I mean, there's a certain paradox going on, I think. If you live in Vienna, in a big city, mm-hmm. it's very common that you have a school where you already see kids in as a minority. You know, the immigrant kids are especially, you know, from Muslim countries and such, are increasingly more and more. And, of course, parents care about this. This led to an interesting hypocrisy that also many liberal types decide to send their children to private schools. You know, they sort of split their brain on one hand.
This is very typical. This is what happens all over the world, in Britain and America as well. Yeah. It's the same thing. The champagne socialists will send their own kids to a private school.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, Catholic schools and so, yeah. And, you know, but there are others. I mean, there are people who actually don't care or don't seem to care or don't seem to see it or don't see to see that it's serious, you know. They say, you know, this idea of replacement, it's not that obvious to many because you have to be aware of demographics and of certain situations. Probably you have to see some things. You know, back then when the refugees arrived in 2015, many people didn't think of anything like a replacement.
No,
let me finish this, please. Mm-hmm. When you start talking about this, you know, you realize people are reacting in a defensive way. They don't want to hear it. And one of the first things you hear, well, it's a conspiracy theory. Oh, somebody's going to replace us. Woohoo, what a joke, you know. And then, I mean, it's not so much important if somebody's doing it. The most important thing is first realizing it's happening, you know, it's a fact, you know. And when you realize the facts, and some take some time to realize, wow, this is actually happening, this is true. Then comes the next point of rationalizing it, like saying, yeah, it's happening, but, you know, maybe it's not a bad thing. We are all people, aren't we? And there is a third stage that is more aggressive that says, well, it's good that it's happening, you know. This is more the hardcore leftists or the self-hating liberals who say, why, you know, what's the problem about this? It's good that we disappear, white people. We have also this thing, you know, you have some stories about that, you know, this thing that people say white people have only done evil things and it's better if they, you know, become a minority among others and all that.
How many people, what kind of percentage of the public would go along with that statement, do you think, if you were to guess?
Wow. I never asked myself that question. I don't think in Austria many. Mm-hmm. I don't think many, you know. Just a certain type of urban liberal people mm-hmm. would mm-hmm. actually agree to that.
It's the lowest of people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but these are often people that are influential, you know.
Indeed, and this is the people, most of the people that I met in Vienna. I also have lots of people around me from school, from older friendships, from the place exactly where in Vienna I'm living, all around myself. It's always...
Bourgeois Bohème? You know that word?
Yes, Bohème.
Yeah. The district where, in Vienna where I'm living, it's just that kind of people. And when I'm talking, say, at a party or in the school surroundings, it's always people who... If you start talking about that, if they don't reject and say, okay, well, I want to talk to right-wing people at all, but those who start talking, they always ask me things like, why I am so fearful?
Are you so afraid?
Afraid.
What are you so afraid of?
Yeah,
you know?
yeah.
And the next question is, why do you hate these people so much?
Exactly. Yeah. And you are also an immigrant, because I'm from Germany and came to Austria 10 years ago.
God, that is so stupid. I can't believe that people even bother to say that.
Or they point at special people that I know, like, you know, that XY's mother is from here. Would you send her back? Well, would you
you know, they personalize it. You know, they start to think and say, okay, but what do you want to do? Do you want to send this poor child back? What do you do about this person? And also, they also assume that you have a very general idea that everybody who's an immigrant, everybody who's a foreign descent, everybody has to go and everything has to be pure and so on. This is, of course,
and the
nonsense.
Problem is if I start drawing distinctions between, like, someone who immigrated from Czechoslovakia or someone from Hungary or someone from wherever, Switzerland, Italian people or whatever, it is a different difference to masses of people from Syria, for example.
And the numbers count, where they come from count, what kind of culture they have and all that.
But
people don't want to make these distinctions.
And then they tell me, why do I make differences between people? It is kind of segregating them and it is discriminating against them.
So for some it's a problem why you are making differences at all. Seen to do that.
Because everyone's human in the end. This is a general beating argument that everyone's human. This is what I'm always confronted to. And there's one thing I wanted to add to what Martin was saying about the new government in Austria. And I don't think that the voters who vote for the Freedom Party or for the, say, conservative, centrist, whatever, FOP party, that they really know and that they have noticed recently that replaced. It is just a question of, say, upper limits, like so many immigrants integrate.
I think it's not even the replacement thing, but it's more a safety question by now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This is a big issue, because there had been terrorist attacks in Germany already, and of course in several other European countries, but of course Germany is close to us, so, you know, this feels like the bullets are approaching. And so I think it's more safety concerns. I don't have so much consciousness about this replacement thing, but people, you know, are getting tired of petty crime or of rapes or of the danger of Islamism, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Islamist...
Someone's just said in the live chat, today in Kandel, a candle, a town in Germany, a 15-year-old Afghani immigrant stabbed a 15-year-old German girl to death.
We just saw it in the news, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a thing. I wrote a little book called The Hierarchy of Victims a year ago. And there were two cases I had in this book. One was a German 19-year-old girl a year ago who was also come to good a bunch. She got killed and raped and in a really extremely brutal way. And it was some, I think he was he from Afghanistan? No, he was from Afghanistan. I just forgot where he was from, whatever, you know. But he came here with a wrong name. He came here with a wrong age. He said he was 17. He was actually over 30, you know.
This is
all the kind of things. So this was one of the first and very brutal cases in Germany.
Your connection has frozen. I don't know what's going on, Martin.
He drove a truck into a Christmas market. Yeah. So I have these two cases, and the question I ask, you know, why are these victims not so important? People who talk about Boris all the time. I mean, you remember that time when this photo was published with the 3-year-old Syrian boy drowned on the Turkish coast. Aylan Kurdi was his name, and it was a huge thing in the media all over the world. This Chinese artist, Ai Weiwei, he made a reenactment where he lies down on the beach, and this child, this dead child, was used as a moral blackmail, you know, and it was all over. The suffering of the child was supposed to be a reason why we have to accept these masses of refugees. But this doesn't go the other way around. The suffering of one person in Germany or Austria who has been killed or raped or victim of a terrorist attack is not an argument to have safe borders, you know. And there are also other cases people forget very quickly. I mean, when a beautiful girl gets raped and murdered, of course, people get more emotional about it. But there was a case in Austria, and it happened a few months after the big influx when she was just a simple proletarian, I don't know, 50-year-old cleaning woman in some rather not so nice district in Vienna, and she got killed by some African immigrant with an iron bar. For no reason, he smashed her head. You know, this was one of the first, the most brutal cases happening here, and this was quickly forgotten, really quickly. And nobody cares about 50-year-old woman who is not pretty or not anything. And so these people who die and who suffer, they are there to the multicultural agenda, sort of collateral damage. You know, because they have a purpose, you know, they have a vision of society. Just like the communists, they had a vision of society too, and on that way, well, you have to do some nasty things, but it's all for the greater good. So, aware of this ideology, of this utopia, they have it in their minds. They have it in their minds, this diverse multicultural society is a good thing to go to, and the people who die and suffer in this way, they are just collateral damage. And this is what I call the hierarchy of victims. You know, I mean, there was another story which also was very telling. This was in beginning of 2015, even before the huge crisis began. And this was the time in Pegida. This was this patriotic movement that had a lot of demonstrations in Dresden and other cities. And there was some refugee being stabbed in a refugee's home in Dresden, and or of course Antifa on the street, and everybody was protesting. It was a Pegida, was it? You know, this was a xenophobic crime. This was a racist crime. And then it turned out that this guy was stabbed by another immigrant. You know, they had a quarrel. Things like this happen often. I mean, even also immigrants.
Oh yeah, yes,
they hate each other. You know, yeah, they fight each other. And so, and at that moment, when they realized that the perpetrator was another immigrant, the victim was not interesting anymore. You know, all of a sudden, interest dropped to zero. So you see, it's not only a hierarchy of victims, it's also a hierarchy of perpetrators. Mm-hmm. It has to be, I don't know, a white, right-wing extremist person. Then it's a scandal. You know, then it's something terrible. And this is really, I think this is a moral question we have to push hard into their throats, you know. We have to ask this them again and again. What about your morals if you make these distinctions? Why are you talking about the people are all the same, but at the moment when they suffer, when they become victims, all of a sudden they're not the same. All of a sudden we have victims that are not worthy of any action, not worthy of safety.
It was also with this Berlin attack that was about at Berlin Breitscheidplatz was the name of the place, where a lorry driver drew into the crowd and killed about
16, 17, something like that.
Lots of people. Mm. And this was just 1 year ago. And the responsible politicians, first of all, Angela Merkel, were quiet about 1 year. There was no official or whatever kind of response or reaction on it. And after the 1 year, they were kind of morally
It took them one year. Yeah. It took the government in Germany 1 year to commemorate the victims of that attack. And you know, they didn't even, when it was happened, they didn't even mention their names. Their names were not published. Nothing, you know. It was, and 1 year later, all of a sudden, they say so.
And then there were some really typical photos of Angela Merkel smiling and grinning and making selfies again.
She's at the Christmas market. Yeah. She's there for the commemoration, and she's having a good time.
Yeah, mm. Yeah. And there were I knew a video of with two old people that were. Journalists wanted to interview them, how they feel one year later, and they really couldn't answer and were sobbing and said, don't ask questions, because their son was attacked. I don't know, he wasn't killed, but from then on he was sick for the rest of his life, and they didn't want to talk about it. And this was the pictures, they were not on the official media.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm going too far here, but in my book, I had another story for comparison, you know. And there was, I don't know if you heard about it, but it's a very shady story and it's not solved. And I think there are many, many questions to it. But it was in, I think, 2011, I think, the thing blew up. Immediately in 2011, it was revealed that there had been a tiny neo-Nazi terrorist cell that had killed Turkish Döner, you know, the Döner snack bar guys over a course of 10 years. Whole thing blew up. Two of the terrorists were dead. One was arrested. It was a woman who is, she's not talking. There's a big process going on, but she's not talking about anything. There was probably involvement of secret services. Anyway, this thing was sold by the media as a terrorist group. You know? It was said this tiny cell, they were terrorists and they had killed these Turkish people. Because of racism, because of pure racial hatred. And now the story didn't make much sense in many respects, because have you ever heard of a terrorist that doesn't, that hides what he's doing? You know, this is not the purpose of terror. The purpose of terror is to let everyone know what you did.
Yes, of course, it doesn't make sense. Oh God, I've lost you again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Lost us.
All right, there, you're back. It's okay.
Yeah,
I'll be back. Okay, I'm sorry. I don't know when you lost me. I was telling the story about this neo-Nazi terrorist cell, this alleged.
Yes, I heard the whole thing.
Yeah. So the thing is, it didn't make sense because prison means that you want to incite terror, and you can't do that if you keep your doings covered. But the way the story was sold is this was a terrorist neo-Nazi cell, and they just killed Turkish people for the fun of it, basically, not because of racism. I can't go into detail. I think the story can be true. But the reaction of the government, and this is why I'm telling this story, was very, very different. From the beginning on, the government made official statements how terrible this is. They had official commemoration. So Merkel was there, you know. They were reading the names of the victims aloud. At one point, even before the process was finished, and the process is still going on, they were naming streets, they were naming places after the victims. They made a huge thing out of it, you know, immediately.
There was a magazine that kind of strange face of this of this woman who was part of the three people group, and she's really not beautiful, but in this photo was really she's the ugly face of the bad, dark German
Nazi.
You know,
it was implied, implied that a kind of collective guilt. It was said this is what comes from Germany again. It was a sort of micro Holocaust. It was saying that it's not just these three guys that hid in the underground for 15 years and committed these crimes. This is this grew out of the middle of society, and it was turned into an indictment of all Germans who are against immigration, who are against multiculturalism, and so on. So,
this is disgusting. Very because clearly, whenever there's an Islamic terror attack, Islam in general is not attacked. In fact, that's what they preach that you must not do. Yet.
Absolutely. Yeah. They always say you can't blame all Muslims for it, and actually this is not real Islam, and so on. And you see what happened here. In one, terrorist crimes, which are very fishy, which probably were not even terrorist crimes, but something else. And we don't even know if these three accused actually were the perpetrators. And you have a cult. Immediately, a cult was created by the government. Merkel was there, you know, to speak about how sorry she is that all these people had to die. And in one hand, you have a real terrorist attack. There's no doubt about it. And you have the government keeping silent, keeping the names down.
And calming everybody down like we have to get used to terrorism.
Let's get hysterical. And in the other hand, they create a huge hysteria. Like, wow, there's everywhere evil neo-Nazi groups who are plotting crimes and so. And you still hear that, you know, sometimes they try to blame it on all right-wingers. They say, you are like this NSU, you know, the National Socialist Underground. And I personally, my personal opinion, the whole story is a hoax, you know. I really believe it. I know I'm into conspiracy theories, but in some, you know, but there are many, many things pointing into the direction. But the point is, why I'm telling the story is this hierarchy of victims and the hierarchy of perpetrators, it's all filtered through a sort of ideology. And no matter how they talk about morals and empathy and how they feel sorry for everybody and how everybody is the same, in reality, it's not. In reality, there is a strict hierarchy of people you have to feel sorry for and not. Yeah.
Yeah, and people who's suffering you should not really care about at all. I mean, every young or old German woman who is raped by a migrant, does that mean anything to these liberals?
No, not at all, not even to the feminists, you know.
Do you hear us?
Yes.
Okay.
We saw this sign. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't even mean anything to feminists. I mean, to some, there are some speaking out, but the majority of them are not. And now, where's all your feminism? Where's all your care about women and about oppressive sexist men? I mean, you know that pattern. It's also happening in the Anglo-Saxon world.
Oh, yes.
That, these feminists talk about rape cultures, but they mean white students, but they never talk about rape culture of Muslims, which is a real rape culture.
Yeah. Or in America, blacks or Hispanics or whatever. I mean, it's always targeted at white men. But how would you describe this, the fact that feminists just forget about the white the German victims and Austrian victims of Muslim rape? How do you think they justify that to themselves?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. Well, they get into a conflict of this in this hierarchy of victims, you know, because feminism is also part of this ideology, which is a sort of kind of neo-Marxism, and the revolutionary classes are not the proletarians anymore, but basically brown people, immigrants. So in the hierarchy of those they have to care for, they are much further up the scale than indigenous women. Yeah? So they get into they have this word intersectionary.
Yeah, yeah.
They get into this intersectionary conflicts here because they have to denounce, according to feminist ideology, rape and violence against women, but then they have the danger of becoming racists. And this is in conflict of this whole leftist model.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be one explanation. There's more going on here, of course, than that.
The structure is always the feminist structures, like the left wingers structures in general, is speaking on behalf of others. There are victims, there are groups, oppressed groups, whatever kind of, not the feminists or the speakers themselves, but always others. Now you have the problem if someone is on the one hand side, part of an oppressed group, like he's a foreigner, he's...
And at the same time, he's a perpetrator.
Refugee, and on the other hand side, exactly, he's a wrongdoer, he's an active and not an oppressed person. So how to decide? Mm. The normal reflex is, leftists react, is they think it's the... And then they go... one step back from this concrete and detailed case, and then they go back to bigger structure and say it's the patriarchic system, or it's society itself,
they try to dissolve it into some bigger scheme, like to say, well, it's not this particular man with the particular culture, but it's patriarchy in itself, but it's or toxic masculinity. They use some general broad concepts, so...
Or it's poverty in the countries where the refugees come from that made a war, that made them...
They find excuses, explanations.
Cultural patterns and so on.
God, it's like dealing with children, isn't it? I mean, if they care about the cultures of these countries, then why aren't they trying to help those countries? They're not. They want these people to come over here.
There's a thing about feminists, and excuse me, Caroline, for saying this, but they're women after all, you know, so don't expect much logic here. I feel there's also something darker going on. Like, is it feminism? This guy, Black Pigeon, you had him on your program. He made some quite nasty videos on that, and I think he's hitting a spot here. If I see feminism is a sort of big shit test, you know, to Western civilization, and Western men are failing, and now you have these males who don't give a shit about this coming in, invading, and there's something in the female psyche. I don't want to get too cynical here, but
Feminists really believe that in every male refugees there's a kind of a little feminist who has to be educated.
What I was pointing at, in fact, some of them do desire these kind of males. They do desire this kind of masculinity. They want the patriarchy back. It's like a cycle, you know. So they manage to dissolve every kind of masculinity in the Western world, and at the end of the cycle, there's a vacuum, and now it is filled with some sort of masculinity, which is, you know, which is actually not fitting to our culture, which is often very brutal and really really misogynistic. You know, think of it like Sweden. I had this example. Okay, Sweden, and you know, I had this example also in my book Hierarchy of Victims. You have in Sweden these very successful novels by this guy. He was a commie leftist.
Which one?
Stieg Larsson, you know.
Yes.
And they made these movies. I don't know how they called them in English. Damnation.
The Girl with the Pearl Necklace or something like that.
That's what I mean, yes. And in these movies, you have as villains, white, Christian, sadistic males. And the heroine is like some sort of, I don't know, lesbian computer hacker or so. So it's a complete leftist wanking fantasy. And these are very popular in Sweden. They make the movies out of it. And at the same time, especially in Sweden, you have this rise of very sadistic, very brutal gang rapes, a real rape epidemic. So, you know, Sweden has become the rape capital of Europe, or I don't know what the actual number is, but I think it's now beyond South Africa by now. And at the same time, you have this fantasy in popular fiction about demonic white males. Yeah? So, and I wonder what's going on here. I mean, I feel there's something deeper, something subconscious.
I was getting mixed up. It's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. But the interesting thing, I heard that the writer of that, this is Stieg Larsson, he died and he left all his money to the Communist Party in Sweden. That's what I heard. I don't know if it's actually true.
I'm not sure. I don't know about that, but he was some commie leftist person. Of course, his books are filled with wet commie fantasies. So that's it. Yeah. And I don't know about feminism. I don't know about the wet fantasies of feminists, actually. I mean, there might be something really interesting happening behind the scenes in their heads, in their minds.
Well, they're totally obsessed with that question. So an obsession is always kind of misled libido towards objects where it doesn't belong.
I mean, sexuality in Sweden is completely unbalanced and derailed. One should write a history about it. Like, the first they start with this Puritan Protestantism. You see it in Ingmar Bergman movies, so people are ashamed of sexuality. Then in the 70s, 60s, you have this, you know, Sweden was the avant-garde of pornography, and also feminism and free sex, and now they are trying to deal with their rape problem by official, you know, the government wants to issue... they want to make sex without written consent illegal. You have heard about that, about Sweden?
Yes, I heard it, but I wasn't sure if... I mean, it sounded so ridiculous. Is it actually...
No, it's true. It's actually true. Yeah? It was also in all mainstream papers in Germany. They are really... I don't know if they're going to make this happen, but they have this idea and it's completely insane. You know, you realize they are completely detached from any reality, and you see that the sexual relations in that country, they are anymore. You have, I imagine, so these nice Swedish white guys, and they are signing, you know, so okay, dear, tonight we're gonna have sex in that position, that position, that position. May I please fuck you in the ass? Yes, thanks.
And she has to say yes, because and she has saying to say, no is not enough.
She has to say explicitly yes, and so, and at the same time, I don't know, Afghani or Somali gangs are gang raping teenagers in Malmö. I don't know. So this is the actual situation, and this is absurd. It's surreal.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the contrast is unbelievable, because, of course, the Muslims will never take this seriously. They'll never get written consent. Sure. I mean, it's just another way to emasculate the Swedish men.
Mm-hmm. Totally. But we are straying far now from what we wanted to talk about. Maybe we should go back to some other points. Maybe we
should let's talk about something more optimistic to end on, because we've been going for about an hour. I think we should tell people about your work, your books, and your what you do for Secession. Secession.
Secession.
Okay. So, yeah, we can. Okay, let's talk about some things that are going on. Surely, yeah.
Yeah.
So, as I said, our book, Living with the Left, and it's a kind of survival guide for right-wing people, how to survive as a right-winger. Social pressure and tensions in family, partnerships, school, workplace, and all that. We collected a lot of information. We interviewed many, many people. We wanted to really write a book for an audience that needs it, you know, that needs some advice and some guide. And we tried to do this. And also, we wanted to instill in the readers a sense of fighting and resistance. You know, this was very important, that we don't want to seem as we want to complain too much. We just want to say, this is it, you know. You have to know when you cross a certain line, the fire will be opened. But there are ways to fight back. So, and also our book is written in a rather comical, I mean, people who read it tell us they laughed a lot. There's lots of humor and satire in it.
Oh, they've gone again. Oh, dear.
Given the book, in the end, well, they really had to laugh a little.
Several leftist reviews, yeah. And they had to admit that it was funny.
Yeah, you know? And this is the mixture we wanted to the people with, on the other hand, sociological facts, and this is full of facts that were recently collected, things that appeared kind of counterculture media and everywhere, and also in the mainstream media. We wanted to use sources that everyone knows. Like, it is obvious, not only on special channels and in our inner circle that we know, but things that are obvious.
Point is, much of our ideas are already there in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And we also have this different types of right-wingers. We also have our alt-righters, you know. We also have our kind of alt-righters. And we see that criticism of multiculturalism and all these things are rising from very different corners. And they need to connect, I think, to create a bigger counterforce. And there are a lot of exciting things actually happening. There was also an election in Germany, which was damaging to Merkel, mm-hmm. Alternative for Germany, this is the so-called right-wing populism party, they had a substantial gain of votes, and this made it happen that, and after the elections in Germany, mm-hmm. they are unable to form a government because they don't get a coalition of parties. There's a problem going on. So there's a change, totally. And I think I also have to mention our book presentation at the Frankfurt Book Fair in October. This is the biggest book fair.
That was fun.
It's a huge book fair in Germany. And we had a presentation of our book, and this attracted a crowd of very nice Bolsheviks who were starting to scream and to shut us down. And but we had a huge audience there. We had probably one of the biggest audiences any... and most book presentations there, and there were shouting matches, and it all turned into big mayhem and destruction. And the next day, of course, this gave us a lot of media attention. All of a sudden, they talked just about our tiny publishing house and about our book. It was all over in German newspapers, and about this incident when Antifa came and tried to shut us down. And even the leftists had to realize it doesn't work anymore. And they even realized they are morons. I mean, it doesn't look good, Antifa. They were clearly in the wrong. And now we have a situation where there is a complete Ratlosigkeit. They don't know what to do with us anymore. They say it doesn't work calling us Nazis. It doesn't work to send us the Antifa. It doesn't work not to invite us to TV programs or
the main strategy was up till then was not to give us any place where to talk and not to give us any
no platform to speak.
No platform,
you know?
No publicity.
There were several strategies. Yeah. One was to say no platform for right-wingers, but you know, if you have a legal we have this legal
admission to this book fair.
To the book fair. We paid money for speaking time, so we can be there. They can do nothing about it because you know it's all completely legal. So what they do, they try to pitch around, they try to boycott us, and in the end, they send us Antifa. And the result is they have to realize it doesn't work. It just looks bad. It looks really bad if people try to shut others down. And at the same time, the book fair was under the motto freedom of speech. And, you know, they were discussing about freedom of speech, but not that kind of freedom of speech. So they tried to keep it very safe. And we were there and just, you know, all the time by just being there. Mm-hmm. And this kind of worked very well. So we have reached a point where we are there. We are obviously quite interesting. Media can't ignore us. Antifa strategies don't work. They don't know what to do with us. And this is a quite interesting situation.
And then comes the point where they are kind of forced to write about us. And even if they use lots of the well-known buzzwords and attributes like Nazi,
hateful, racist,
xenophobic,
Völkisch
against humanity, and so on.
Against democracy.
We can really play a bullshit bingo game with all these words they were attributing to us. But in the end, to do is writing about us or talking about us on whatever.
And then happens what happened to you. You read in some paper about it and you get interested and you see
exactly.
It's actually pretty interesting what I find there.
So it's a matter of generating controversy.
It was interrupted. We didn't hear you properly.
I just said it seems to work if you just generate controversy and attract attention to yourselves, because then the media, the mainstream, has no answer to what you're saying.
Except for telling us that we are only here to provoke and only to trigger them and to do nothing but being controversial. This is the only purpose why we are
provocation,
there.
We do use provocation sometimes because you have to. Because if they try to silence you, not giving any platform, you have to break this silence by a provocation. For example, like the identitarians do when they create these actions on the Brandenburg Gate. This is a moment when you crave attention. You say, hello, here we are, talk. So this is the way.
Or if it's super stupid, you can't do nothing but trolling them.
But provocation is just a part of it. But they try to frame it as we are merely provoking, that's all. But this is not the thing. I mean, I'm not here to provoke. I'm really here to argue. I really mean what I say, and I think I have good arguments for that, and I want them to be heard. I have to mention this also. There was a second book at the Frankfurt Book Fair, which was much discussed, and this was curiously called Talking to the Right. And it was written by three guys. One was a philosopher, one a lawyer, and one some writer of novels. He's the guy who wrote most of it, I think. And it was a really strange, weird book. These guys obviously have read a lot of what we had written, And there were many rather esoteric references into it, which only we could really understand.
The strange thing is they were calling the book a manual. But if you expect a manual, then
our book is a manual. Our book is, their book is a mindfuck, actually. But, you know, they had lots of reviews. Also very successful. Our book kind of is parallel to it. So on Amazon, people who buy theirs also buy ours. So they can compare. The titles are very similar. And they made a point. They have a one point where we agree is when they say it doesn't work anymore just to call us Nazis and racists and shut us down. They realized maybe we really need a talk, you know, maybe we should really do some high noon and see, bring your big guns. In the end of the book, they have this chapter where they say, why not do it? You bring three of your best guys, we bring three of our best guys, and then we have a real that. Let's do it. But, you know, they pulled back, of course. They got pressure from leftists and antifas as well, which is very funny. I had quite a schadenfreude on that because now they realize themselves how it's happening. But this book, the success of this book, the controversy it created is also a symptom that things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
And I still hope we can have some high noon with them or with some other people who are intelligent. I mean,
when they have uncacked again, because now I think they really feel kind of pushed into a corner where they never wanted to be, like being addressed as being those guys who want to talk to the righteous. They are kind of righteous themselves, and this is
sure. For some, even if you say talking to righteous, this is already too right wing to say this, you know, even if you're not right wing yourself. So the problem is also we have this in our book, there are no really leftist opponents that are worth it. Because it's becoming boring because they're so stupid. I mean, I want a leftist who is really ready to give me a high noon, you know, and so we can have an interesting fight. But they are not there, and they are also not trained. I mean, we are trained because we get this leftist shit all the time.
We have to defend ourselves.
We have to defend our times, and they exist in their bubble. Everybody has the same opinion, and some nasty right-wingers are outside there. They are kind of, you know, destroying the bubble. They're afraid of it, but they're not used to debate. And they feel a bit too self-assured, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the writers of the book also felt a bit too self-assured. The book is very arrogant in many parts. It's also funny in some parts, but it's also very arrogant. Like, okay, we see through you. We know what's happening. Their main thesis is that right-wingers, they have this way of provocation. They provoke these people who have not the problems they have, problems with identity or anything else. And when they have provoked them enough and they react, they can scream, oh, my God, I'm a victim, I'm oppressed. This is the scheme of right-wingers. And they are, of course, it's entirely wrong. There are so many problems about it. First of all, I mean, provocation is just the thing you do when you have nothing else left, you know, then you take provocation to create a debate again and to disturb this bubble. And the next thing is that these people we supposedly are provoking until they react, they are not passive, they are very aggressive, and they don't leave us alone. I mean, do you see leftists leaving other people alone? No, they are spreading their ideology in a very aggressive way. Every day they find new ways and new levels to spread it, new ways to classify something as racist or whatever. So basically, by now, it's a sort of self-defense that is necessary.
Indeed. And,
but self-defense is not enough. You have to attack also.
It's also really definitely not funny and not a kind of playing the victim thing if you're attacked by Antifa or if you have whatever kind of oppression, or if you lose your job, or you lose friendships. It's not doing it for fun.
Yeah, this is the thing they always say. We are playing the victims. Ha ha. You know, I mean, if Richard Spencer gets kicked in the head, he's playing the victim. So to have an example from the Anglo-Saxon world. Yeah? If the car of some AfD politician is being burned, he's playing the victim, you know. If I lose my job because I posted a comment on Facebook, I'm playing the victim. This is what they always say. Yeah.
Because their logic is, well, nobody has to be right-wing. We could also get
rational. It's your own fault. It's why are you right-wing? Why are you saying this? Why are you doing this?
So the question in that Talking to the Right book is really, why are you assholes? You don't have to be.
Talking to the Right book, they have a whole chapter that
assholism.
About assholism. They say, you're assholes. Yeah. Why are you assholes? Why? Okay, you're assholes too.
Well, that's not the way of talking to each other. We really...
We can call each other assholes and then we can start talking. But,
Okay. So, well, to summarize then, do you think that in spite of all this, there is progress being made, that identitarianism in Austria is growing?
If identitarianism in Austria is growing... I think so, definitely, and it still will. I mean, there was an interesting thing happening last year when we had the presidential election, and so you remember the Green Party guy won. There was the Freedom Party guy and the Green Party guy, and it was quite an interesting left-right-wing match, but the Green Party guy in his campaign, he had all these very patriotic posters about Austria and how we are unity and this is our homeland. This was very, very funny. And the thing is, he realized win anymore without using these themes, because even all those left, these liberal, not the really leftists, they of course not, but this, you know, middle class, typical liberal people who want to be good, who believe all this bullshit, they still want their homeland deep inside. So he had to appeal to this. And I think this will increase, and I hope so. I mean, I hope we're on a good path now. I mean, we are already being mentioned of being more closer to countries like Hungary or Poland or so. I find this also historically very pleasing. So we have Austria-Hungary again. And I hope we will become urbanized, you know, like Orban. So I think Austria has to become more urbanized.
And there's another thing from my perspective, is that if you speak out, if you just out yourself as identitarian or as right wing or whatever, and then there's always the typical reactions is that most people are definitely or overtly against you, but there are some people starting to think.
There will always be at least one who reacts.
At least one person.
And not immediately, maybe. Uh-huh. But there is something happening. You really can do something if you have the courage to out yourself.
Kind of a law where we have also put it in our book. This is...
The form of an outing law, which means that whenever you out yourself in front of a group of so and so many people, there will always be 1%... I don't know. This is just made up the percent, but somebody will react. It will leave some trace.
You get some kind of immediate feedback.
It will have an effect.
One person, but for five others, who start thinking. The seed is put into the earth, and then the soil is
growing. Then planting growing. The soil, and we want to encourage people to do it more and more. Mm-hmm. And the more people to do it, the easier it will become.
But some
have to be the first to step over the line. Some have to do it, and sometimes it's just tiny things. You know, it's like, you know, every pebble counts in this fight. It's a sort of, you know, intifada in which every pebble counts against the tanks. So we encourage everybody to do something, even if it's a small contribution.
And then you can really feel kind of satisfied if you get kind of Christmas postcards with people who have, in my case, a person who I haven't been talking to him for... say about two or 3 years, and then he wrote me a Christmas card. Like, he's really proud of me because he knows everything from the media, what happened to me and what I was doing all through the year. And he must confess that he's kind of right wing too. And this is the really satisfying.
I mean, you had people positively react to you. Mm-hmm. There was a report in a leftist Vienna paper. And you had a woman in a subway who was talking to you after you appeared. She appeared on TV, me too. And people are talking us up. People are recognizing us, talking us up. Good job. It happens more often than, to me, it happens more often than wishes reactions. They happen too, of course, you know. But I think I had more positive reactions by now. Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, you appeared on TV, didn't you?
Yeah, we did appear on TV. It was a private Austrian TV station. It's financed by Red Bull, you know that drink? And the guy who produces Red Bull, he also finances this TV station. And they have very interesting political discussion rounds, which are different from those in Germany, because they actually do have people with different opinions. It's actually different opinions. You know, in Germany, it's usually you have one right winger and five leftists, and they ritualistically eat this one guy up. You know, and here we have, I don't know, two right wingers, two left wingers, somebody in between, and this makes very interesting results. And they are also doing it because it's a successful model. Mm-hmm. Because people are tired, you know, of hearing time saying the same things. It gets more exciting if you have in a TV discussion actually different opinions.
For example, the group I was sitting in, it was about the question of democracy. Does democracy still work or is it doomed? So we have we had people. One person was an anarchist, really a strange guy. Mm. And me being introduced as an identitarian, that was really cool because moderating the thing was introducing me like, this is Caroline Sommerfeld, she's close to the identitarian movement. Nobody was
they didn't make a big deal out of it. She was, she was presented as on equal footing with everybody
exactly,
else. And this discussion, interestingly enough, it wasn't that polarizing.
No,
you know?
No,
nobody really antagonized you. There were difference of opinions. It was different when I was there.
Yeah, it was really fighting situation.
It's my nature also.
Yeah, but
but this was really interesting.
There was another person, a woman was a lawyer and wanted to reform the participation of Austria. Another person was favoring the Swiss model of democracy. There were, it was kind of an open discussion. The only person who was really kind of attacked by everyone was a
He was a social democrat liberal. He was an investment banker. He was a PR manager for Social Democratic Party elections, and he was basically okay. I make it simplified. He was this kind of globalist type, and everybody hated him.
Yeah.
In this discussion. I mean, even you and the anarchist guy were hooking up against him at one point.
Exactly.
You know?
This was a this is a situation you can't. And copy and say it's could be the same in Germany. No, this is impossible. Not I think the difference is not that this is a private broadcasting station, and it's not that.
Or, you know, TV in Austria is very state dominated. So we have a state TV station, and this is of course very left wing liberal. The new government says they want to change it and make it more neutral because it gradually has become very partitioned over the time. And Servus TV is an alternative to that, which is quite successful by now. And also Mateschitz, the guy who does Red Bull, he's also very critical of immigration and all that kind of stuff. Do you know that guy who jumped from space, Baumgartner? Have you heard that story? The stratosphere?
No.
No, yeah, it was a big story. I mean, it was no human being in history ever did that. And it was a huge thing. And Red Bull financed this thing. And Baumgartner, he's also an open sympathizer to the identitarians. And he's a huge star in Austria because of this jumping from the stratosphere onto Earth. And this is quite interesting, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds quite ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. It's like a comedy, but it's a true story, I'm telling you.
Okay. So, all right, to wrap this up, because the next person's coming on soon, so I need to end this one. So where can people find your stuff?
Secession.de. You can put the link on your video description. I will send it to you. And okay. You can find me on Twitter, Marty Lukmes.
Ah, yes, I'll add your Twitter as well.
I think I won't. I need my time.
She's a mother of three, not like a girl. You have to useful things, not like me. I can Twitter all the time.
Okay. All right. One question. Why aren't you smoking a pipe, Martin?
Because I have forgotten it back at my parents' home where I was for Christmas. And I was desperately looking for it before the show started because it has become a sort of a trademark. And it was very popular in our last video. In the comment sections, people always mentioned the pipe. But this time, unfortunately, I hadn't it with me.
Oh, that's a shame. And also, people are asking if you could say, get to the chopper.
Get to the chopper?
It's Arnold Schwarzenegger in Predator. It's the Austrian accent.
Deck down, deck down. They are coming for you. So, you know, so get down. Get to the chopper.
Okay.
Yeah, I know what you're doing a bit Schwarzeneggerism here, yeah.
All right. Okay, let's leave it at that. So it was good. I think it went well. And I think people are well introduced to you now. So this is Martin Lichtmess and Caroline Sommerfeld.
Sommerfeld, exactly.
Sommerfeld, okay.
Sommerfeld. And the next...
Summerfield. Oh, yeah. It means Summerfield. Isn't it nice?
Yes.
Nice name.
Yeah.
Okay, and the next one is with Mono... I don't know how to pronounce this, but they're Finnish. It's the Swan of Tunella. Monokulturi FM. So that's in about half an hour. Okay, excellent. Well, thank you, Martin and Caroline. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
It was a pleasure. Very fun.
Okay. And thanks, everyone, for listening. I'll see you soon.